Alice Boyd. Up next on Think, the joys, sorrows, and contradictions of the bond between dogs and their humans. We'll spend this hour with Alexandra Horowitz, who runs the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College. We'll talk about how dogs try to tell us what they want and need and why we're likely to guess wrong if we assume they're just like us. We'll compare the cadence of our conversations with dogs to the way we talk to babies and hear why Horowitz takes a contrarian view on the necessity for spaying and neutering family pets. Our conversation starts after a short break. Spend quality time with a dog you like, and you might feel like a different person.
Petey, you're such a good boy. Are you a good boy? Oh, yeah? You're a good boy?
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We can tell our dogs know their names, and they listen for key words like walk, even if they can't understand everything we babble at them. But have you ever stopped to wonder how well we understand them? Maybe we could be even better friends to our best canines if we spent a bit more time considering the world from their point of view. Alexandra Horowitz does that for a living as senior research fellow and head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College, Columbia University. Her new book is called Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. Alexandra, welcome back to Think.
It's really nice to be back. Thanks.
So when you're out and about in the world, you pay attention to the things that people say to their dogs. And you've discovered it's not only about the dog. We talk to our dogs as a way of talking to each other.
Yeah, I think so. In fact, I should say I didn't always hear the things we were saying to our dogs. It didn't occur to me that I was overhearing conversation regularly or even to try to attend to it. And I didn't even know that I was talking to my dog so much. But in fact, it appears that we are talking to our dogs a lot. I almost never shut up. I'm constantly including them in a conversation. And I think in some ways, it's a conversation we're having with ourselves.
So most of us have kind of special ways of talking to our dogs. How do we talk to them when we actually want them to understand us, when we're, say, giving them a command or trying to tell them something we need them to know?
Well, short declarative sentences, usually words that we'll use reliably. So we're not trying to be creative or inventive with our prose. We, you know, want to go for a walk is a pretty traditional sentence in our house, and I'm not going to vary it if I'm asking my dog. I'm not going to say, are you interested in a perambulation this afternoon? You know, it's not, I will say the thing that I've always said to Finnegan, and he's likely to understand it. So this kind of creative conversation is something that means maybe that we do with our dogs, means maybe we're not expecting them to respond.
Hmm. We have a code word for walk in our house. We call it a W when we want to talk about it but don't want to get our dog excited before it's time to go.
Right, right. Although sometimes that backfires and they just start to spell.
Right. They're that smart.
Yeah.
How does pet-directed speech, as you call it, compare with the way we talk to babies?
You're right. It's actually a good comparison. We speak to babies in what researchers called infant-directed speech or baby talk. And it's a high-pitched voice. It's repeating a lot of words. There are a lot of harmonics. It's very sing-songy kind of speech. We use a lot less complex vocabulary with babies than we do with adults, typically. And so all of those are actually exactly the same as how we speak to dogs. So there is a lot of overlap. Sort of dog-directed speech is also very much like, hi, doggy. Hmm. You know, it's high-pitched. It's sweet. It's like you're talking to a child. But there is one interesting difference that I've seen, which is that we don't hyper-articulate our words as much with dogs as we do with children. With children, we're trying to teach them the language in speaking. So we might say, look at the doggy. You know, it's like really extended. But we're less likely to do that with our dogs because we know they're not on their way to being language learners. We're just having a conversation.
Do men and women talk to dogs in roughly the same way?
Men talk less to dogs than women has been my experience, and also is the evidence that researchers have found when they've looked at people talking to dogs in any kind of context. And that's kind of true with babies as well, actually. Women are more likely to talk more often, to drop in a little term of endearment talking to a baby or a dog, and men are less likely to, which doesn't mean they're immune. They do the same things. They're just a little quieter about it.
How can we know how much human language dogs comprehend or at least associate with certain actions and ideas?
Well, we can only look at their behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, most of the things we say to dogs, there's no reason to imagine that they comprehend, right? And in fact, I'm not sure that we're asking them to comprehend. If I sit down and I say, I've just had a rough day, Finnegan, I'm not really looking for commiseration. His presence is commiseration.
Yeah.
So he doesn't need to comprehend the content or even really the tone. It's just his being there and listening to me and not, you know, talking back, which is actually the ideal conversation at that moment.
So I've noticed that if my dog is beside me and somebody calls her from the other room, she'll sometimes pause for a second before she runs in there, almost like she's trying to figure out, like, did I just hear what I think I heard? I remember hearing years ago that some hearing problems in older folks are not so much about, like, damage to the structure of the ear as about a slowing of auditory cognition processes. And I was wondering, is it possible dogs need a little extra time to comprehend, you know, those particular key words that we speak to them?
You mean older dogs?
Or dogs of any age?
I think actually, the former is probably more likely. Mm-hmm. You know, there's cognitive decline in dogs just the way there's cognitive decline in aging humans. And it's hard for us to see because we haven't been asking them to do a lot of cognitive tasks most of their life, right? But it is in little moments like that where their attention seems to wane or they sort of they look like they might forget what they're doing, that we might be seeing a little bit of just normal aging there.
You remind us here that we haven't completely made peace with who our dogs are to us. We think of them as members of the family, but legally they are possessions.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most interesting contradictions in the current state of living with dogs, of dogdom, and its culture. We think of them as family members. Most of us would, without a hesitation, call a dog a member of the family. And yet, to the law, they are property. They are chattel property, and their value is what you paid for them at the shelter to adopt them or from a breeder. And that's their entire value. And we see this come up in the law in cases like divorce cases, where two parties are splitting and they might ask for custody of this living creature who's been part of their family, and judges resoundingly reject that language to talk about the dog because it's property. So they assign it just like they would the family silverware.
Hmm. If dogs will, you know, continue to need people to provide and care for them into the foreseeable future, how could we move them out of the status of possessions, knowing that someone is going to have to sort of be responsible for them?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think a somewhat an answerable question, but there are legal scholars who I write a little bit about in this book. We're thinking about, what other statuses besides mere property could there be? There are people, Stephen Wise and the Non-Human Rights Project is working on expanding the notion of personhood, which already includes lots of entities which are not humans, but who have certain types of rights, to include animals like chimpanzees, who we very much see as kind of person-like in many ways. Another option is that a scholar named David Favor discusses is to maybe introduce a new category which is relevant for lots of types of animals, which would be maybe living property, right? That, and maybe we would still own animals but have different kinds of responsibilities to them than we do now, responsibilities to a living creature and to their well-being. Because right now we don't, as a culture, have responsibilities to dogs. You can do almost anything you want with your property, except for excessive and unnecessary animal cruelty. But boy, you can give them up, you know, if you decide you want to give them up. And that doesn't seem appropriate for this animal that just a minute ago we were talking to in baby talk and, you know, we consider our family members and sleep on our beds.
It's strange that we have different categories even among our pets, right? I mean, you don't necessarily think ill of someone who says, well, I'm moving, and so I gave my lizard away or my snake away. Mm-hmm. And some people might disagree mm-hmm. with that, but I feel like the mammals in our lives somehow hold a different status.
Yeah, I think that's because we can recognize their cognition and their abilities and their experience more easily than with reptiles, for instance, or fish, which are also, you know, widely left or abandoned or just sort of released into the world, right, without any thinking about whether a domesticated animal can survive out on their own. And I think that's kind of a poverty of our imagination. And there's not enough science right now to really give us fodder to say, you know, we should rethink that.
You've been meeting dogs in your lab for years, but none of them are lab animals in the classic sense. So can you sort of explain how you get study subjects?
Yeah, sure. And I think it is important to say that because sometimes people hear I have a dog lab and they think, oh, no, you know, like you have rows of cages of dogs lined up. And it's not at all like that. The lab is an empty room, essentially, awaiting dogs and their persons, owned dogs, coming in when we have a study. And then usually the owner stays in the room because without the owner, the dog might get anxious or just be uncertain about being left in a strange place. So the owner just sticks around. We ask them just to be quiet and say nothing. And then we're presenting the dogs with some kind of puzzle, maybe. You know, is it a choice of two objects? Can they, will they choose for us their preference based on smell or based on cues which we experimenters give them? We might give them a smell, something to smell, and then see, do they notice when that smell changes? So they're usually very short studies. Dogs might be in there for 30 minutes, and they can, in between trials, hang out with their owners. And then they're walked away, home with their person. So the lab is just a place for us to, a neutral place for us to meet. That's not my home. It's not their home. And it's a place where something, one interesting thing will happen, hopefully.
Does the sort of self-selection factor by the dog's person, the dog's owner, if you want to use that language, does that contaminate the studies in any way? In other words, the sort of person who is into their dog enough to enter their dog in a study might not be an average owner and therefore might have an animal with a different experience than sort of your garden variety American dog.
Absolutely, and it's something that we acknowledge when we write. It's just like any psychology study, which uses undergraduates, you know, as their subjects because they're a convenient sample. You know, the convenient sample is a big problem in all of psychological research, all laboratory research. And so in those cases, I'm saying, yeah, I mean, maybe my conclusion is not generalizable to all dogs, which it never really should be anyway. There's a lot of different types of dogs. I also do observational studies out in the wild for dogs, which is, you know, just outside with their persons or with other dogs, maybe watching dog-dog interaction. And at some level, that's a little less convenient sample biased because there's a wider variety of dogs. These dogs might not even, and the owners might not know they're participating in this study, right? I'm just observing behavior. But then again, you know, those are people who take their dogs outside. And there's certainly people who don't take their dogs to be socialized and don't take their dogs to the park. So we are always trying to circumscribe the kind of type of category that we can make conclusions about.
What sort of contact do you have with your canine subjects as a scientist? Do you have to avoid sort of directly interacting with them?
Yes, I do, right? Because dogs are so sensitive to humans and are so interested in engaging with humans for the most part that if I or my researchers were to greet the dogs as we ordinarily would greet a dog, then the dog might just be interested in us, right? And just might want to, in a confusing test situation where they're not really sure how they're supposed to behave, they might look for cues from us or just come and wait by us for the next, you know, idea of what's going to happen. And we really don't want that to happen. So it's my researchers' great disappointment that they can't pet or even like look at the dog until the end of the study.
My guest is Alexandra Horowitz. She is Senior Research Fellow and Head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College, Columbia University. Her new book is called Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Senior Research Fellow and Head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College, Columbia University, Alexandra Horowitz. Her newest book is Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. So I overheard some members of our production team talking before the show today, Alexandra, and one person said, well, my dog has anxiety. And somebody else said, my dog has anxiety too. And I was wondering, is there an uptick in dogs that have what might be called mental health challenges these days, or are we better at spotting their problems because we're better at spotting our own?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. In fact, we are as a society more attuned to mental health issues, and our gaze has looked toward dogs more than it used to. That's always increasing. And so we're likely to see those predispositions and behaviors in our animals. And in fact, I think there is a kind of low level of anxiety that lots of owned dogs have because they're in an uncontrolled environment, right? They're not in control of their lives at some level. So we've created a dog which is a little sort of ready, and one could call it anxious, to respond, ready to kind of go whichever way we're going to go. So it might be some of both.
Do they pick up on our emotions and reflect them back to us?
Sure. Emotions can be contagious across species, especially with dogs and people who are attached. You know, the dog-human bond isn't just a kind of way of speaking. They show actual attachment to us, the classic attachment that we talk about with children and their parents. And so emotions can be, you know, conveyed across that hyphen between dogs and humans in the bond.
You have some concerns about the anthropomorphization of dogs in TV shows and movies, which is just a fancy way of saying we look at them as if they're just like us. What are screen dogs made to do that is at odds with the way actual dogs would express emotions?
Yeah, I feel that sometimes I'm come off as very humorless in this respect because I do not celebrate the dogs who are just stand-ins for people in movies, right? So talking dogs is a classic example where you have a kind of stop a dog whose mouth is moving and who is voicing words that would never come out of that dog's mouth. You know, they're just supposed to be a person. And what we enjoy about it, or what some enjoy about it, is that it's sort of extra funny because the dog has the person beliefs. And I guess I don't find that the kind of an interesting way to think about dogs. What's interesting to me about dogs is that they're just not exactly like us, right? That they wouldn't, you know, be concerned with their long work hours or finding a mate in the same way. You know, they have different concerns. So I love movies which try to capture that instead.
I've always been sad, a little sad, that my dog doesn't smile, and I realize now that's probably a good thing.
You know, we're very drawn to dogs who have that upturn of their lips such that they look like they're constantly smiling. And that's a normal human reaction, you know, to see a smile in that, even though it's just a way their mouth is framed, right? The dolphin does not smile. The dolphin just has a mouth whose lips go up near the edges.
And some dogs actually make a smile-looking face when they're stressed out?
Yeah, a panting face, you know, it could be relaxed, but it could be stressed. And the guilty look, which I've explored quite a bit, involves sometimes a teeth-baring smile. Hmm. It's kind of a smile. It's like a grimace, right? But that's really an appeasement behavior. It's like a pleading behavior, like, please, you know, I'm sorry something went, I don't know what happened, but something's bad. You seem angry. And so they're pleading to you to not be angry. And so, boy, if my dog was showing that all the time, I would be really concerned that they were just scared.
All right. So to be clear, it's not that they've been thinking all afternoon, I shouldn't have jumped up on the counter and eaten that loaf of bread. We come home and find the loaf of bread and they see that we're upset and then they act guilty, or what we think of as guilty.
Yeah. The guilty look is a response to us. I've done research that showed that. Other people have pursued and done this and replicated that same finding. The look is real, and they also do things that are sometimes we think of as wrong. But if we think about it, it's really not that hard to understand that dogs who are waiting around all day with nothing to do might do something which we consider a wrong behavior, you know, they're not thinking about it as wrong. They're thinking about it as just something to do. That smells really great. I'd love to get that thing off the counter. And then they're highly responsive to us. As soon as it looks like we're coming in and might be angry, they put on that pleading face.
Hmm. How can we be better observers of our dog's emotions? What should we be looking for that we might overlook?
I think the challenging thing with our dogs is that it's so easy to assume we know what's going on. And the best thing I can do, and I have my researchers do this too, is just really to imagine they've never seen a dog before. Imagine that's an alien creature, and then just try to explain their behavior if it were a creature that you've just come upon and never seen them before. And then you start to see the behavior and describe it at a level which starts with just what they're actually doing. And maybe the attribution of emotions will be appropriate, but it's not the first thing we start with.
And how much can they convey with their faces as compared with the rest of their bodies?
They don't have the same kind of musculature as the primate face, but there was recent, really lovely research that showed, for instance, that dogs have a muscle that allows them to raise the inner eyebrow. Some dogs do this very effectively. You might sort of even recognize the look. I love dogs who have kind of profound eyebrows. Mm-hmm. And it gives them a little bit of a puppy dog face. And wolves don't have that muscle. This is what the researchers found. And the result is that they can make an expression, and we love the expression full face, right? That is a human face, a face that can make lots of movements. So the more they can do that, the more we're compelled to them. But they still can't move the, smile or even frown, right? They don't have the same types of muscles around the eyes or nose. They're oriented towards other things, you know, smell-related things, not visual expression.
So I typically have small dogs, and therefore I just need them to respond to sort of basic instructions and do what I tell them, but I don't need them to be just incredibly well-trained. I'm sure people will disagree with that choice, but sometimes I feel bad for dogs that seem so trained that they can't do anything without sort of looking to a human for permission, but maybe I'm wrong. And, you know, people often say this dog loves to train and only wants to do what I tell it to do. Is there a right or wrong way to do the amount of training that a particular dog will receive?
It's a really interesting question. I don't know that there is a right or wrong. My tendency is to try to see what gives the dog a pleasure. I think having to wait for all the instructions from a person is not pleasurable. On the other hand, doing something, like being asked to do something and be involved in something together, is often pleasurable for dogs. So there might be certain kinds of training which are more likely to do that. I really like sort of games, scent trials, nose work that people can do with their dogs, where the dog is being given a task, but it's, you know, a non-serious task. It's find hidden scents in an area, and they're rewarded for it. They're good at it, and the person isn't directing them. The person is just giving them permission to do that. So that might be a type of training. It is a sort of training which it satisfies both the dog's need to do something and also a responsiveness to person.
You trace the history of dog food for this book, and it is fascinating. How did we all come to be convinced that the only proper diet for dogs is like these pellets from a bag or chunks from a can, something that is specially prepared for dogs?
Right. It's actually a pretty recent phenomenon. It popped up right around the time that purebred breeding was becoming popular in the mid-late 19th century, and it was a business proposition. You know, a fellow named Pratt noticed this kind of biscuit, hard tack, it's called, that was fed to sailors on long voyages because it kept very well. It was a wheat or oat biscuit. And he thought, well, you know, we could repackage this. It was already being used for some livestock. We could repackage it and call it a food for this new growing population of dogs who were going to need their own accoutrements, just like we like to have our own accoutrements. And he did. And he, you know, started to describe that not only should certain dogs have this larger biscuit, but smaller dogs or smaller breeds should have this other biscuit, and individuate types of foods for types of breeds. And there wasn't any science behind that, but it was a commercial proposition and people bought it. And they also were led to believe that it would be more convenient. Nobody had complained that it was inconvenient to feed the dogs. Usually they were fed leftovers. But they, you know, the claim was made it was inconvenient, and here they were solving the problem of inconvenience by giving you a bag of food. And our culture bought into that, and we still do. And now, of course, pet food companies do have a lot of science behind the nutrition of their products. But it's still, it seems to me, a very funny phenomenon that we think dogs need a special food made just for them, right? That's a conceit.
So it would be like the equivalent of taking everything that all the nutrients that we need and putting them into some kind of biscuit and saying, from now on, this is, you're just going to eat this perfect human food.
Yeah, or baby food, right? Mm. Like babies, there are certainly things that babies should eat. It's not great to feed them just chunks of meat, right? But you know, you don't have to have a packaged baby food, mm. right? You just figure out what's appropriate for that stage of development. And similarly for dogs, one could do the same. But it takes a little time. It's inconvenient to have to maybe come up with a well-balanced program for your dog. And it is convenient to buy a bag of kibble and put it in your dog's bowl. So that's what most of us do.
I want to talk a bit about dog breeds. It's interesting, and I was interested in the book when you say it's a relatively recent thing that we have delineated particular dog breeds. I had assumed that they'd been around forever because of the jobs that certain dogs were associated with.
Right. Well, there certainly have been types of dogs. You know, when we say breeds, we mean purebred dogs. That's what we're talking about. And purebred dogs, meaning dogs who can trace their lineage to specific dogs who are all interrelated, pedigree dogs, that only happened about 150 years ago at latest. Many are much more recent breeds. And those dogs, that's responsible for the a variety of breed types we have today. There always have been different looking dogs and dogs who were more adapted to certain tasks than others. But for the greatest part of dog history, they were selected for behavior, for function. And then this really changed with pure breeding in the late 19th century when they started being selected primarily for looks. And that's why we see the tiny, tiny dogs with the short face or the tiny legs and the giant dogs and all this diversity in between.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Sometimes when they're bred just for a particular appearance characteristic, that can have some health consequences. Is that right?
Unfortunately, it is having health consequences for many breeds. In fact, there's probably not a breed that is unaffected by many generations of inbreeding. But there are more profound problems in certain breeds where we've changed their bodies quite drastically. And so the classic cases of these are the brachycephalic dogs, the short-nosed dogs, like a pug, like the bulldog, like the French bulldog, who really suffer a lot of, for instance, respiratory distress by their noses being, the respiratory pathways being kind of collapsed with the shortness of their nose, and often can't breathe without surgery. You know, you'll likely, if you see a bulldog or a pug, you see them panting. Mm-hmm. That's not because they've been working hard, you know, right before you see them. That's because they're trying to breathe. It's like breathing through a straw. And so that's their constitution now, these breeds. And we've done that to them as humans. It's fascinating to me that we still look at that dog and think that's cute. Well, what we're seeing is a dog who's in distress.
You remind us that it's hard to guarantee we're getting a puppy from anything other than a puppy mill, even if we buy from a kind of reputable pet store. First of all, help us understand what makes puppy mills problematic. What does that term mean?
Puppy mill is a term used to mean large-scale breeding operation, and of which there are many. And those breeding operations are creating new dogs for commercial purposes, just to be sold. Mm-hmm. Those dogs are not dogs who are, you know, raised in somebody's kitchen and growing up with their kids and living in the backyard until they come to your house. You know, they are farmed animals, essentially, only they're dogs. And they're going to, because of their confinement and because of the lack of socialization, they have, you know, great problems with might crop up in their future lives. Then there are a lot of breeders who are, we might still call puppy mills, but are smaller scale breeders. So they're not producing thousands of puppies a year, but they're small enough so that they're actually unregulated. So there are no regulations about how you should bring up puppies. And pet stores have to rely on puppies from some sources. And those are the sources they use, those institutions. And I think this is an unfortunate reality that just like the, you know, the meat that we buy at a supermarket is, we don't have to see the process that went into it. There's no animal being slaughtered for this to happen, but there's a lot of possibility for oversight and neglect when you're just talking about making dogs as a money-making proposition.
All right, let's go quickly to the phones. James is on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, James.
Hi, good afternoon. Great show. It's interesting. So I have a black lab, and when I talk to him, a lot of the times he looks at me and tilts his head as if I was speaking a foreign language, which maybe I am.
Sure you are. I mean, it's not his language, but I think also dogs tilt their head as a way to, maybe not to indicate, but they're showing some attention, right? They're trying to get more information from you. It's a little bit of a prompt that we use with ourselves, frankly. You know, you might, if you're confused or you don't quite understand, you move your head a little bit, and it's a way to try to get more information. So your dog is actually probably making a request for you to say that more clearly.
Alexandra Horowitz is my guest. She's Senior Research Fellow and Head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College. Her new book is Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. Chris Boyd. Alexandra Horowitz is with us this hour from the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College, Columbia University. Her book is Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. So widespread spaying and neutering is like an assumption that we make in the United States. If you are to be a good dog or cat owner, this is something that you do like as soon as possible. You have looked at this in a different way and remind us that there are places where people think of de-sexing, which is another term for this, as unnecessarily cruel.
Absolutely, yeah. And I have to say, I never really thought about this twice. All I ever knew were dogs who had been spayed or neutered, and cats as well. I was just handed the fact that society has kind of solved this problem for us. And it was only over time and with lots of little instances that provoked my interest and new research that's come out about how early spay and neutering especially can be quite deleterious to dogs that I started thinking, wait, how did we get into this situation to begin with where to be a responsible pet owner, you are spaying or neutering your animal?
Well, a lot of people are concerned about unwanted or homeless dogs and cats. Has the widespread practice of spaying and neutering helped with this?
You're absolutely right that that was the prime mover of the policies. We used to, as a society, it's hard to know the exact figures, but 10 or even 20 million dogs and cats were being euthanized every year. That's because we had this huge overpopulation problem in the 70s. And it's absolutely gone down quite a bit, although not to zero. You know, we still euthanize millions of animals every year. So it isn't a solution to the problem. In the intervening years, lots of other things have changed about how we live with pets. So it used to be much more common that dogs, for instance, were not contained. They were just let run free, which, of course, would have contributed to large unwanted or stray animal populations. We now have microchipping, which allows dogs to be returned to their owners if they're wandering or lost. So there's a lot more dogs who might be picked up who don't wind up being killed in the shelter. They wind up getting their back to their families. We have changes in our attitudes about our pets. So they are much more family members now than they were even 40 years ago, 50 years ago. So lots of things have changed, and spay neuter is certainly one of the contributions there. But it is informative to look at other countries, for instance, that have, for instance, Norway's small country, but an interesting example where they, until recently, had it illegal to spay or neuter an animal. And they didn't have a large stray dog population running around Norway. You know, they found another solution to an overpopulation problem. And their solution had to do with thinking about the animal in a slightly different way in their life, not as an animal you get to surgically alter because we don't want more puppies.
Beyond the recovery from the surgery itself, is there evidence that spaying and neutering causes dogs to have a diminished quality of life?
Well, it's certainly the case that, as a researcher named Benjamin Hart and his large team of fellow researchers at UC Davis have found, that lots of dogs are more likely to get cancers or joint diseases if they have been spayed or neutered. It's different by breed, and he does this interesting work looking at the breed because it's individual. They also are much more likely to be obese. You know, the hormones that you remove when you take out the reproductive organs are hormones that are not just about reproduction. They're about testosterone. It's about muscle mass. It's about bone density and bone growth. The hormones are involved in memory function and brain function. So once you remove the major producer of those hormones, there's a systemic result. And I think that's something that we hadn't been thinking of when we saw this as a important solution to solve overpopulation.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time we have Tanner calling us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Tanner.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Hi.
We have a lot of friends that have dogs, and we also have a dog. And we've noticed, or I've noticed, the popularity now of these, like, 23andMe dog DNA tests. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you have done any research into those, and if they're even, because, I mean, they just seem kind of crazy to me.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for the question. Well, in fact, they're improving. You know, they're not perfect genetic tests, and there is good science behind them, but they look at a very limited part of the genome, and they're making conclusions based on, just like with human DNA tests, the pool of samples they have. So I think what they do right now is satisfy, if not with the whole truth, some plausible truth, the curiosity of people to know about the origin story of their dogs. And I think at some level that's very sweet, that we are interested in knowing the back history of our dogs, just like we want to know who our ancestors are. They're not going to give us the whole truth yet, you know, but there's science there that's they're improving that ability.
How much can we tell by dog breed how a dog is likely to behave?
Yeah, not nearly as much as we'd wish. You know, genetic predispositions to behavior exist, as with people. But dogs' behavior is entirely just like us, a combination of their predispositions and what they're exposed to and what happens to them in their life and the things who they meet and the consequences of their actions along the way. So there's no dog who is, for instance, as people would resoundingly like to say sometimes, aggressive, just always aggressive dog. And there are no dogs, as breed standards would like to say, who are like reliably good with children, right? Mm. There's no breed, which is so even though people will allege that that's the case, you know, those, you know, historically always aggressive dogs can also be extremely gentle for their entire life. Those extremely good with children dogs you know, can be surprised and bite a child. And so we think of behavior as coming straight out of the genome with dogs for some reason. But of course, just like our genome, you know, we know that we are a result of both our biology and what we're exposed to in the world. So too for dogs.
Let's go now to Ken in Austin. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Hi.
Very, very good conversation. I have a 16, I'm a senior, 76, and I have a 16 and a half year old Cocker Spaniel who has been a joy, but he's not going to be with us forever. He's had all kinds of allergies and ailments. What we're thinking about is our next dog when we lose our puppy. How do we avoid the puppy mills and all the things you've been talking about and get a dog that is suitable for a senior?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I'm glad you're thinking ahead. I hope you still have some years with this dog. You know, mixed breed dogs are not from puppy mills, frankly, and they're terrific dogs. You know, you're not getting, as sometimes the kennel clubs will want to say, they think you're getting some kind of uncertain, troubled dog. You know, you're just getting a dog which actually has better genetic health. There's no guarantee with any dog that they're going to behave, you know, resoundingly like you'd like for their life. But these, I think, dogs, mixed breed dogs are a mix of what are sometimes extreme behavioral tendencies. And that kind of mellows them out a little bit. Also, you might consider getting a dog who's not a puppy, right, who's already somewhat matured. And that might be a better fit. I wish you luck.
Aaron is calling us from Houston, Texas. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Thank you so much. I really have enjoyed the conversation. So I've always been impressed by dogs' cognitive abilities, particularly that they're able to follow commands in so many different human languages. And I was wondering kind of how that is, what enables that, and also and to what extent does that show that they have kind of a deeper cognitive experience, that they are more than just their behaviors, that they have like some sort of psychological life?
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I think that we're very predisposed to look at language as one of the most complex things we do. Dogs don't do language the same way as us. I think that their ability to conquer it in some cases is a combination of two things. One, their real astute observation of us, right? They'll watch us and look for behaviors, and that includes language behavior, which helps them predict what's going to happen next, gives them something to expect. They want to know what's happening in the world, and our language, if we speak clearly, is telling them. So dogs will attune to that. And the other part is we have to use language in a certain way around dogs for them to understand. So Chaser, this now quite famous border collie who recently died, who lived with John Pilley, a psychology researcher for many years, they spent 8 hours a day with John talking to Chaser using specific words again and again in reference to toys that Chaser then learned and, you know, knew the names of 1,022 toys. Well, that's just not how most of us talk. And dogs aren't predisposed to pick that up unless we talk to them carefully that well. I think what it shows cognitively to your question is that they're highly attuned to our behavior. They watch us sometimes, I think, better than we watch them.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So my teenage daughter was devastated recently. There was an article that many dogs do not care for being hugged. So are there good ways to show our dogs that we love them?
Well, you're probably showing your dog that you love them all the time through, you know, being with them, spending time with them, playing with them, if, you know, sitting with them, touching them. They often like contact with you when you're sitting. Attention is the showing of affection. Yeah, and some dogs are fine with hugs. You know, that's definitely something that varies dog by dog. I think it's a really great place to look for how we assume so much about dogs being identical to us. Of course, dogs don't hug each other.
Right.
And so it is a little strange for us to grab them by the neck. And it's useful to look out for the behavior that shows they don't like that. But then what do they like? You know, maybe they like a scratch around the chest or their ears. And you'll see that. You'll see the affection received through a wag of the tail or a lick or standing around for more.
How important to dogs is the company of other dogs as compared with the company of people? I've heard different things.
I think it very much varies by dogs, uh-huh. which is maybe why you've heard different things, especially if a dog has not been socialized to people during their young life. They might really find much more of a social comfort in other dogs. Most dogs, though, are very comfortable around people and could be almost a complete substitute for seeing lots of other dogs if they had lots of other human companionship. The problem with most owned dogs is that they spend a lot of time without human or canid companionship during the day. You know, they're left alone.
Would they sleep all day if they weren't sort of in an empty house? I mean, are dogs in the wild more active?
Yes, an interesting question. There aren't really wild dogs, but if you're talking about free-ranging dogs, you know, dogs who are strays, they are more active, yeah. I mean, certainly they sleep a lot. That's part of being an owned animal, is that they don't have as many things they need to do, such as it were, in order to survive. But they're sleeping because there's nothing for them to do, right? And you look at working dogs. Working dogs spend the day engaged in a task. They don't suddenly nod off in the middle of their work because they just have to get that 18th hour of sleep. Hmm. They're engaged, and so they're alert and awake for it.
Do dogs mind being dressed in clothes? It's not a thing in our house, but I know people who very much love their animals and are convinced that their dog feels better like in a sweater or a little tutu or whatever.
Yeah, I can't really find any justification for saying that a dog feels better in a tutu. I mean, I think that has to be all human. I think that some dogs really are off-put by having costumes on, and you can see it if you look at their behavior. And others, it doesn't matter. You know, that's attention to humans. It's attention by their humans, and that's, I think, what they're experiencing. To me, as a person who has a choice to put her dogs in clothing or not, I think, is this like the type of relationship I want to have with this animal? You know, my interest in dogs is as dogs, not as little things I can dress up. And so I don't dress them up.
Alexandra Horowitz is Senior Research Fellow and Head of the Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College at Columbia University. Her new book is called Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. Alexandra, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us.
Chris, thank you.
You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. We hope that you'll subscribe to the Think podcast and leave us a review to let us know how we are doing with the show. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.